Coming up, a conversation with the CEO of the D.C. Central Kitchen. Mike Curtin oversees this massive Washington, D.C. project that deals with food, but it is so much more. This is a story about social enterprise, about rescuing people from food insecurity, not by feeding them, but by training them. It's about corner markets in food deserts that people write off and say, those people won't buy fruits and vegetables, and he proves it all wrong. Click through. You are in for a major awakening. Mike Curtin from the D.C. Central Kitchen. Insight on Business, the news hour, is made possible through the support of Taro International. Look, the number one reality is that if you possess great interpersonal skills, your career path gets easier to walk. From communication to collaboration to learning executive presence, it's Taro International. Achieve, lead, and outclass with TERO.com.
Insight on Business, the News Hour with Michael Libby is made possible through the support of Aureon, Human Resources and More for businesses and nonprofits, AUREON.com, Remax Concepts, real estate professionals with offices in the Des Moines Metro, Nevada, and Cedar Rapids, realestateconcepts.net.
It is the Business News Hour. Thanks very much for clicking through. With me is Mike Curtin. Mike is with the D.C. Central Kitchen, and we're talking about Washington, D.C., and he comes by that via a restaurant background, an interesting Japanese connection. We've been having an off-mic conversation. I'm really struck by all the things he's got going on with D.C. Central Kitchen, as well as something called social enterprise. And he's in Iowa to speak at the Tomorrow Plan series through the Metropolitan Planning Organization here in Des Moines. Mike, thanks so much for taking time to do this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. We were talking about this off mic, but I want to get into this a little bit because
sure.
You spent time in school studying Eastern religions, which led you to Japan, which then led you back to the United States to do some work with the Sanyo Company, who happened to be in Arkansas. Am I parroting all this pretty well?
You're very close, yes. Close enough.
And the governor at that time was then who?
A young guy named Bill Clinton.
Yeah. And so how did you get hooked up with all this?
Well, so I got hooked up with the two Japanese brothers who ran the Sanyo Electronics family when they purchased a small boutique hotel across from the White House. They had gotten to know a young Bill Clinton as governor of Arkansas when they put a manufacturing plant in his state and wanted, when Bill became president, they wanted a place to stay for the inauguration that was close to the White House. And so they said, well, what's the closest, nicest hotel to the White House? Let's buy it so we can stay there. And that turned out to be the Hay Adams Hotel. So I was hired to promote that hotel to Japanese business folks. This was 1990, so the height of the Japanese business boom. And there were big plans to buy more hotels, to buy golf courses, marinas, a large sports and entertainment complex.
You were flying.
Oh, it was going to be great. It was fantastic. I thought I took advantage of this opportunity. I learned to speak Japanese and spent about almost 4 years there, and this was really paying off. But that's a couple of years into that, the Japanese bubble burst, and with that, my dreams and hopes for this high-flying international sort of executive lifestyle, and I decided to give restaurant business a go. I had been fascinated by a particular style, a concept, a ubiquitous concept of restaurant in Japan.
Explain what that is.
It's called a izakaya or robadayaki, basically, and it's become, without people knowing, it's become very prevalent here in the United States. The concept is, and these places can be very, very casual, almost literally in someone's garage, to something crazy fancy and expensive that would cost $500 to $1,000 a person for an evening. But the idea is very simple. Most things are what we would now refer to as small plates, or mm-hmm. served on small communal plates, mostly grilled, fresh, emphasis on fresh,
locally sourced, local
ingredients. Yeah. Food comes out when it's ready. Drinks also are almost served communally, whether it's beer, wine, sake, and everyone pours in. And it's a dining experience. When you go out, you rarely are going out to dinner and then to something else. Dinner
is
a 3 or a 4 hour experience, yeah, when you're just having fun and hanging out. And I just thought it was a really interesting idea that could be replicated in the States.
And pronounce that again for us.
It's izakaya.
Izakaya.
Or robadayaki, means small grilled things is the literal translation.
Interesting.
Yeah. So again, small plates before people were calling small plates small plates. But I also recognized I needed a little more experience. I did get some food and beverage experience at the hotel. So I worked for a couple of folks that had businesses, had restaurants in D.C. And then in 98 struck out on my own and opened my own place in a suburb just outside of Washington, and had that for about 4.5 years. As I say now, I often refer to that as my first experience in the nonprofit sector, was owning and operating my own restaurant.
Isn't that the truth?
It is the truth. It's a sad truth. Now, thank God, 14 years later or 16 years later, I can laugh about it. But that gave me the opportunity to get to know DC Central Kitchen and Robert Egger. Basically, we started in the business at about the same time. While I had my restaurant, I volunteered at the kitchen. I did some fundraising for the kitchen. I made donations to the kitchen, and was always fascinated by the work that it did, and got to know Robert from different restaurant style events within the association locally. But never did I think that this was a possibility for a career
choice, right?
I just didn't think that. And then until after I got out of the restaurant business and was doing some consulting, and that was going fine, quite frankly, but came across an opportunity for that time was this chief operating officer at the kitchen. And I said, wow, this is fascinating. This is possibly an opportunity to take all these different kinds of things, whether it's the Japanese sort of management style of consensus building, having worked in a restaurant, really focused on training and customer satisfaction, creating community. My restaurant, the biggest goal was not, I knew it was good food, it was great food. We called it casual semi-fine dining, but it was never going to win food awards, but I wanted to win community awards. I wanted to be the centerpiece for our community.
So it was really other-centered.
Yes.
I mean, the real job, was creating an experience for people that they could enjoy and talk about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately that's what restaurants are. I think we forget that. And that's the way I went about it. And I thought that, wow, I could bring this together at a place like DC Central Kitchen and you know, maybe grow that concept.
All right, let's talk about DC Central Kitchen. This is in Washington, D.C., obviously, and been around for a long time. What at its core is DC Central Kitchen?
At its core, it's interesting. I always say there are two principles, our two bedrock ideas upon which the kitchen is built. One is that although people think about us, when they hear the name, they think of food, they think of meals, we are based on this idea that food will not end hunger. You know, we are an anti-hunger organization that uses food not as an end but as a means, as a tool to strengthen bodies, empower minds, and build communities. So food is what we use, but it's not going to solve the problem.
Correct. And that's where we get into the social enterprise action, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. So number one is that food will not
end hunger. We won't feed our way out of hunger. Number two is that accidentally and inadvertently this exercise of charity, of philanthropy that we've been engaged in as a country somehow had moved to a place where it was more about the redemption of the giver and not the liberation of the receiver. So the kitchen is all about that liberation of the individuals that we are working for and working with. So there was this idea that really this charity had been really focused on the value that it brings to the person doing the work, as opposed to are we actually liberating people and hopefully striving to eliminate the need for charity. That's what we're trying to do.
Totally get it. So let me see if I can parrot this back. You're doing this on a regular basis. For example, let me give you an example. In the capital city of Iowa, in Des Moines, the unemployment rate among black individuals is running about 13-15%, give or take. Now, that includes also underemployed individuals. In the rest of Iowa, the unemployment rate is tied for like the lowest out of three states at 2.4%. So one of the things that has been bubbling around is trying to create an empowerment zone or an incubator for black individuals who can then not be fed, to use your language, but actually work towards independence through economics.
Sure.
Is that where we're going?
That's exactly what the kitchen is all about. And we use the food industry, the food and hospitality industry to get there. So what's been interesting about the growth, and then this goes to the social enterprise piece, is that often people, and several times just in the short day or so that I've been here in Des Moines, visiting with other folks in the community, people have mentioned the old proverb of it depends which refrigerator door magnet or bumper sticker you read, if it's either a Chinese proverb or a Middle Eastern proverb or an African proverb, but give someone a fish, feed them for a day, teach them to fish, feed them for a lifetime. The next question has to be, that's great, but what if all those fishermen and fisherwomen are unemployed? So that's really the question that the kitchen has been interested in answering by not just feeding and training, but then employing, and not only employing, but being the kind of employer we want others to be, like focusing on other community value besides simply getting a job.
We are with Mike Curtin, ladies and gentlemen. He is the speaker for the Tomorrow Speakers Project, courtesy of the Metropolitan Planning Organization. Mike, I think you could probably find a lot of people in Iowa that could really dig into something like this. And I know that there is a fellow by the name of Nick Kuhn who has started the Justice League of Food Trucks or something like that, and I may have that misconception, but out at the hall in West Des Moines. And I understand you guys had a conversation.
Yes, I was fortunate enough. My friends from the Harkin Institute who facilitated this whole trip brought us out there yesterday, and I got to meet Nick and his wife, Lynn.
Yes.
It's an incredible operation that they're running and the kitchen they're building to engage this group of youth, focusing on 18 to 24-year-olds, which we are actually doing as well back in Washington, D.C. It's quite remarkable. Even when you give those numbers, they fairly well mirror the situation in Washington, D.C. It really is remarkable that we all are dealing with the same issues, regardless of where we are in the country. But the demographic and the systemic issues that we face on the East Coast are the same here as they are on the West Coast and North and South as well.
So you are taking individuals through the D.C. Central Kitchen and putting them through some culinary training at the same time, and then many of those individuals come back and work for
right.
you?
Some do when we have openings. We are not a jobs program, so we don't create jobs to pad our numbers. So most of the individuals will go work in the hospitality industry in Washington, some in restaurants, but more we're looking for jobs in what we would call institutional food, that's in museums and cafeterias and schools that tend to be a little more stable, better wages, better benefits.
Right.
Also, hotels provide a lot of that opportunity. But then there are some who are really attracted to the buzz and the hipness and the sexiness of the restaurant industry, and that's cool too. You know, it's whatever works for individuals. But we are bringing folks back. We will always give preference in hiring, and that almost exclusive preference, quite frankly, to folks who graduate from our program when we are building our businesses, whether that's our catering business, contract foods, or our locally sourced scratch cook school food business.
And many of the individuals who you've reached out to train have had some issues with the law.
Yes, everyone that comes to our program has faced significant barriers to employment, to self-actualization. Often those barriers are interventions with the criminal justice system. We've had folks that have been incarcerated for 10, 20, 30, or even more years. And coming out of that situation, it is very difficult to find a way to support yourself. And that is why 70% in our country, 70, that's 70 listeners, of people who come out of that situation will end up going back. And that just costs us all about $50,000 a year.
Yeah.
And so just a criminal waste of resources and something that we're working to overcome.
And the dozens and dozens and dozens of people that you have put through the D.C. Central Kitchen, what's the recidivism rate there?
Our recidivism rate, and thanks for asking, because that's a very important question, especially when you want to look at our work from through an economic lens, is less than 5%. So you think about for the nominal investment, it's about $10,000 a student. We are literally saving hundreds of millions of dollars on an annual basis And this is just one program, one small program in the basement of a shelter in Washington, D.C. If you think about the possibilities as these programs, and they have been replicated across the country, we're talking significant money. But even more importantly than just the money now, we're talking about breaking this generational cycle that we see in incarceration, in addiction, of violence, of abuse, of trauma. And that is ultimately where we're going to find success.
Mike Curtin is with us, ladies and gentlemen. Tell me then, what is the secret sauce? How is this so successful?
Well, there's a lot of answers to that question. I think one of them is that, I'll try to do two real quick. One would be the fact that I mentioned our founder, Robert Egger, came from the hospitality business as well. He was a nightclub guy. He did not intend to do this. This was not something that, like many of the younger generation today, kids were involved in volunteering and being part of the community and giving back. That was not his gig. Quite frankly, that wasn't my gig. I mean, I would like to say I did do a lot of volunteering when I was in high school. My family was very much the notion of social justice was an important one in my family, but I never saw it as a career move, as something that as opposed to something we did extra. Or on the side even. So when Robert came to the kitchen, started the kitchen, and then when I followed, we were both looking at this not from that social service aspect of we're in this to end hunger, we're in this to save people, which is a weird power dynamic in and of itself, but we're in this to make things a little bit better. And I think that if
so you stumbled into this?
So we stumbled into this, right? I stumbled into it, as did Robert. But I think the reason I've been able to continue to stumble through it is that I'm looking to do a little bit better every day. We call it at the kitchen relentless incrementalism. So we are not going into this saying we are going to end hunger. We are going to end poverty. We're not. You know, that's not going to happen. But if we can make our shared community a little bit better today than it was yesterday, then we're winning. And to me, that's the secret sauce, because that inspires us to keep going. It doesn't frustrate us because we know we're not going to get where we want to get.
You can do incremental wins.
Yes.
And then, yeah,
absolutely.
And then keep it going.
Yeah.
Social enterprise.
Sure.
Let's define that for just a moment. This is where you guys are working so that you don't have to do this any longer, right?
Well, actually, sure. So one of the things I'm going to talk about today, we like to think of ourselves in a very self-important way as righteous entrepreneurs. And we've developed what we call 8 rules for righteous entrepreneurs. Today, I'm going to talk about the first rule. But the 8th rule is that we have a moral obligation to put ourselves out of business or fail trying. So I think that's what you're yep. talking about, is that we are in business. You know, here we are. We love to tout ourselves as a business, right? This is
we are
a business, but our business model is to put ourselves out of business. So one could argue not a great business model. But ultimately, we know that there will always be another business to get into to put ourselves out of that business. So ultimately, that's what we're trying to do, is create value and create to change people's minds, to shift the business paradigm, if you will, to a place where these unseen lines on a profit and loss statement are not only seen but valued. Mm. And if others start doing their business a little differently, and if they can do it better than we can because they have the infrastructure and the resources that we don't, then it's our time to step aside and say, what's next? That's really what we're here to do, is we're here to change people's minds. So oftentimes, it's not unusual to hear someone, whether it's someone in the nonprofit community or a theoretical study of social enterprise and nonprofits, say that nonprofits and social enterprises really need to act and think more like business. Well, my response to that is, if business had done this so well in the first place, there wouldn't be a need for us to do what we're doing. And so my view is that what we're really doing trying to do is to get businesses to think and act more like nonprofits and social enterprises.
And because at the end of the day, you're really creating a better world.
Well, yeah, I think so.
Individually,
yes.
With
sure.
individuals who
Absolutely.
Are then able to go out and do their thing.
Right.
We're talking with Mike Curtin, ladies and gentlemen. He is, along with a whole bunch of other people, D.C. Central Kitchen, Washington, D.C. A couple of things that caught my attention is this process that you're doing locally sourced foods and vegetables and things in corner markets.
Yes.
And tell me about that.
So it's a program we have called Healthy Corners. It really came out of, again, it's a very, it's basically the formula in my mind of how social enterprises should start, right? So for years, there have been consultants and mayor's commissions and blue ribbon panels in urban as rural, well as rural centers across the country when they studied the local food system. And inevitably, one of the conclusions is we have food deserts. That's areas where people don't have easy access, affordable access to fresh, healthy food. And what can we do to overcome that lack? One of the things that typically people point to is let's get more fresh fruits or any fresh fruits and vegetables into corner stores, small neighborhood convenience stores that serve mostly as the people's main food source because they don't have the access to these grocery stores. And then after that announcement or that proclamation has been made, usually the group will adjourn to the cocktail party and congratulate themselves on a job well done.
Write a
and put the report up on the shelf until 5 years later when they come back to readdress it. And so we said, okay, what can we do? Quite frankly, the food deserts is a great example of how business hasn't functioned to solve a problem. So it's very understandable.
It's understandable, sure.
Right? So if I'm a produce distributor, it's going to cost me the same amount of money to drop off a case of vegetables as it will to drop off 1,000. And I get paid, obviously, a lot more to drop off 1,000 than I do one. And most corner stores don't even want a case. They want 3 pieces or a half dozen pieces or whatever it is. So DC Central Kitchen, were in a position that said we can – we are, because we're not interested necessarily in making money on this transaction, we can subsidize that loss. And this is a case actually when it's not pure, I would say, so self-sustaining social enterprise, but an interesting hybrid between social enterprise and philanthropy. We can subsidize that business loss to build what will become a self-sustaining business by doing exactly what business doesn't want to do because it doesn't make sense, and doing small deliveries to small places in remote areas, and areas that it's, you know, instead of going into, you know, a strip mall when you're just, that's your, you got a big 18-wheeler, you're coming in, that's your delivery for the day and you're done. We're doing 15, 20, 30 drops a day, small drops that are labor intensive, but ultimately getting food to these places where it didn't exist before. And one of the things, when getting back to this notion of getting people to change their minds, right? So one of the, when people would say to wholesalers, you know, you guys really should deliver to these corner stores, and a response would be, well, you know, people in those neighborhoods, they won't buy fresh food. They don't want fresh food. And the response would be, oh, yeah, I guess you're right. And people shrug their shoulders and say, I guess so. And then just sort of like, and then the conversation's over. Well, first of all, those people will be right. As long as no one delivers food, no one is going to buy anything that's not there. It's never happened in the history of the world, right? But what we have shown since we started doing this, and especially, and this is what really made the difference, when we started producing and selling value-added products, so cut melons, cut celery and carrot sticks with vegetable dip, anything that to make that transaction a little easier, the stuff is flying off the shelves. So clearly, this notion that individuals, particularly in economically marginalized areas, won't buy fresh food is
ludicrous.
Exactly.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. And we're showing that not only that the desire is there and the market is there.
Okay, let me ask about the mechanics of that. So where you're getting all of the produce and all of the things, are they then shipping it to DC Kitchen and you're physically taking it out? Is that how that
yes.
works? So that makes sense. Yeah.
So we're either buying from a mainline wholesaler or, and depending on the season, we're about to get into growing season in the East Coast and the Mid-Atlantic. A lot of the product that we will sell this summer is locally sourced, that we will actually go to different growers, pick that up, and bring it back, process it, and put it into the stores.
And many of us here in Iowa are going, wait a minute, you have locally sourced food in Washington, D.C.?
Actually, which is, I tell you, there's some crazy cool stuff happening. And we go basically from southern Pennsylvania to the Shenandoah Valley, which is about 200 miles is what we talk about. Now, as the season extends, we'll go as far south to North Carolina. But typically, we're in that band, in that 200-mile band. There has been in D.C., as there has been in many urban areas, a push for urban agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is one group in D.C. that is growing microgreens in D.C., and we are selling their product in the corner stores in the most economically marginalized and challenged parts of our city. Really cool stuff.
Fascinating stuff. And that whole urban gardening thing is a deal.
It is. But I think it is important, too, when we talk about urban gardening, that we recognize that we don't think, again, this is going to feed people, right? This is going to end hunger. It's not. It can create opportunities. It's phenomenal for community building, for education, for kids to understand where food comes from, to reignite that connection with the land that's so important that we've outgrown or moved past in this country. But some of these smaller businesses are indeed creating opportunities for business, and that we're being able to put this stuff in this product in the corner stores and see it sell is a pretty powerful little business cycle that we've created.
It really is. Mike Curtin, ladies and gentlemen, is our guest for the interview. Mike, final question, if I can. When we're talking about all of these things that are going on in D.C., and we know what the poverty level there is, we understand that, and we can understand that just a stone's throw away from where you and I are sitting right now, as a matter of fact. What do you want Iowans to get from your visit here? What's the point?
Well, I think one of the points is that, again, that I've seen in the short time that I've been here, that the challenges are the same, but that means the opportunities are the same. What exactly how we do things in Washington might not be directly analogous to what works in Iowa, but the bones do, the ideas do. One of the parts of the conversation that I've had with some folks over the last day or so, particularly regarding the schools, and we do a lot of work with school food, is that we work with a small number of schools in a very compact area. So that's a significant advantage than, say, the whole Washington, D.C. public school system or the whole Des Moines public school system. That's a different animal that we would not be able to do some of the creative things that
we
do.
But you can pick and choose.
But you can, right? And you can, and again, relentless incrementalism. If we can't do it all now, we sure as hell can do some of it today, and then a little more tomorrow. So I think ultimately that's the lesson. You know, what works, it might not work exactly the same way, but it works. And if you work hard to figure what that is, you can create massive change in your community.
Fascinating conversation. His name is Mike Curtin. Ladies and gentlemen, he is DC Central Kitchen. Mike, thanks so very much for spending time with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Once again, that was Mike Curtin, the Chief Executive Officer of the DC Central Kitchen. I know you learned something, didn't you? Go ahead. Yeah, you did. I really enjoyed having that conversation with Mike. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. in May, and I understand that the D.C. Central Kitchen is just a couple of blocks from our hotel. I hope to hook up with Mike once I get there and check this place out for myself. If you want to check it out, we will have links to the D.C. Central Kitchen up on our radio blog. Well, that about wraps it up for another business broadcast. For all of us associated with the Business News Hour, Chap Ramsey is our production coordinator. Sales and marketing falls to Aaron Libby. The voice of the Business News Hour is Hunter Pease. The music you're listening to right now is arranged, composed, and conducted by our friend James Goodlett from Jam Good Productions. You need some original music for your next project? We can hook you up. For Mike Curtin, my name's Michael Libby. Have yourself a wonderful evening. Be safe, be well, be careful most of all. Be good to your fellow man. Good day.